Yeah, or at least a segue.
Oh, and we're live.
How to put up with all my crap, eh? All right, we're live.
Yeah.
The Go Ahead and Bitches Podcast 169.
You guys.
That was a good one. This week we have Sentinel. He's got a super amazing and educational YouTube channel. Thanks a lot for joining us, boss.
Happy to be here.
We also have Marty.
Hey, how's it going? Oh, we got
Roger. For a
second. Hey, good evening, everybody. It's going to be a fun show tonight. We're going to talk about bugs and controls and stuff. Yeah.
We got JR Tokyo from Cannabis.
What's up, everybody?
Hey, JR.
Hey, what's up?
What's up, man? It was a fun having a session with you on Saturday, Sunday, whatever day that was, Sunday.
Yeah, it was good. It was good being able to link up.
Yeah, man. Always good times hanging out with you and Fish Ganja Guy.
Yeah, I know you like Fish's new place. Not bad, huh?
Oh, yeah. We filled it up with smoke quite well.
Yeah, we did.
Tested out his smoke detectors. Make sure they work, you know?
That's right.
All righty. Well. Zenfinal, why don't you tell us a little bit about your YouTube channel and what you're all about? You're one of the coolest YouTube channels that I'm aware of in terms of pest management, and you got so much good education and good footage on your channel. Please tell us more about it.
Well, sure. So, for those who don't know, my name's Matthew. I don't have a problem with going by Zenfinal or anything like that, but my YouTube channel I started around in 2014. And mainly it's a passion project because I was just so used to working in like the floricultural space, and I've been working with cannabis for about 9 years now, but more focused on cannabis for the last like 5 or 6. And I just felt like there was a lack of information with regards to like pest management, like organic, holistic, integrated pest management strategy. I mean, even more traditional crops. Well, I wouldn't say that hemp is a cannabis is a non-traditional crop, but and even crops that had not been prohibited for a long time, like people are not getting into IPM as much as they could be. And so, in the cannabis space, it was both it was disappointing to see some people who just didn't really care, and it was refreshing to see. Over time, how much that has kind of changed in the last few years. And so people have been really hungry for this information. And when I was younger, I used to think, oh, well, nobody's going to care about this when I get older. I should find something else to do. But it turns out that because not a lot of people care about bug stuff and it's important, it makes you really important, especially in California where it's an agricultural mecca.
Yeah, so tell us more about some of the content that you have.
Well, one video I'm actually working on currently that will be posted in a few days, possibly even tonight if I get it all done, is it's about a pest that's going to be, I think it's going to be a problem if we don't work proactively, and that's the spotted lanternfly, which if you haven't heard, it's from China and Vietnam area. Of the world, and it really prefers Chinese sumac, which is a really common sort of ornamental tree that's pretty much everywhere in the United States. And this lanternfly feeds on like over 70 species of plants, especially like grapes and hops and also cannabis, as well as like apple trees. In Pennsylvania, they've already caused like hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of damage. And they're in 4 states in the United States right now, Delaware, New Jersey, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. And they've been here since 2014. And my big concern is that it's going to be a problem for hemp going forward if we aren't able to contain and control it.
Yeah, I had never heard about spotted lanternfly being a cannabis problem. This is really interesting. I know I've seen a lot of Septoria, which especially at the scale and a couple of different species of Septoria this year, and a lot of new viruses that I hadn't seen, especially as well.
Yeah, I recently talked about the well, the thing about it is that I haven't seen any. I've seen two reports, both in Chinese. I shul some Zhongwen, which was terrible pronunciation, but I do speak some Chinese. I used to speak it better, but now I don't. But both of those reports are in Chinese, and they were, one of them is from 1945 or 46. I don't remember off the top of my head, and they found it on hemp. So my concern is that, like, this is just a latent problem waiting to happen. But I haven't. But to be fair, I haven't seen any recent reports of it on cannabis in a big way. But I feel like it will be a problem in the future, perhaps under the right conditions. And there's more. I also recently talked about the lettuce chlorosis virus, which is a virus of many different plants, and they found it infecting cannabis in Israel, actually. And it's vectored by the silverleaf whitefly, which is really, really prominent in California and actually the whole world, for that matter.
So how do we kill those flies?
So tell us more about this lettuce chlorosis virus. I've never even heard of it.
So lettuce chlorosis virus is it was discovered in Southern California in the late, if I remember right, the late 80s? Yeah. And around the same time that Bemisia tabaci, the silverleaf whitefly, was becoming a problem. And the silverleaf whitefly has a lot of different predators and ways to control it, but certain populations see it's a species complex, actually. It's actually a group of a bunch of different identical populations that have specific traits, and you can't really tell by looking at them who's who. But certain populations are very resistant to pesticides. Other populations, or the same population, rather, the Q, what used to be called the Q biotype, but is now referred to by its origin moniker, which is like Mediterranean 1 or something like that, or maybe that's B, but it doesn't matter. The point is that there are lots of ways to combat it. You can use natural chemistries for those that they aren't resistant to. You can use entomopathogenic fungi like Bouveria bassiana, which kills it by infecting it. But the lettuce chlorosis virus, the whitefly only has to feed on your plant for like an hour to transmit it. So even if you do kill the whiteflies, you're still likely to be infected by this incurable virus. At least it's incurable currently in all hosts that are known for it. And it can cause like total crop failure. So that's going to, I think, be a big problem for California cultivation in the future and possibly other parts of the world. In fact, it's possible people are dealing with it currently but don't know to look for it because it's only recently been, like, as of like August, the report just came out. But they found it in cannabis in Israel for, like, the last 3 years, so since 2017. And so it's possible that it's been in other circulations. I mean, it must have been before it got to Israel.
So is there any way for people to at home to have any way of telling when something's viral other than, you know, picture identification? Is there a way they can do anything through any type of sampling or anything that would help them you know, better evaluate what's going on?
Very good question. I think that there are ways that somebody can. Sometimes viruses, and especially creamy viruses like the lettuce chlorosis virus, can have different specific traits that are visual, that are apparent. And crinoviruses also interact with other viruses and can cause really odd symptomologies that aren't typical for either the virus. And they're even competitive against each other, which is kind of interesting to consider. But it
reminds you almost of that Three Stooges syndrome from The Simpsons. I don't know if you remember that episode, but
remind me again how that went, because I am.
Mr. Burns had so many diseases that the different diseases were counteracting each other.
Oh yeah, that's right. I remember. Yeah.
But sometimes that actually happens in plants, though.
Yeah, it does actually. Or like sometimes you get a situation where, like, because when you think about it, you know, pests, they're in it for themselves. They're not, like, on the bad guy team and they're all, like, sharing in the bad guy loot. No, like, a pest that cuts off another pest from, you know, infesting its host can potentially reap more resources. And so adaptations to that end can be useful. But, like, in other cases, for example, you have, like, mites and aphids, and, like, they both suck plant juices out. However, they have different, like, ways of doing that, and they also have different ways of shutting down the plant host's immune response. And so sometimes even you have organisms that will turn on the defense pathways for different pests when they feed. So, like, I think if I remember the report correctly, I don't want to be misquoting anything, but I think it was two spotted spider mites on a plant. I think it was Arabidopsis, which is Thale cress, which is used in a lot of experiments as a model organism. And when it fed on the plant, it actually made the plant have an immune response similar to what it would not for spider mites, but for I think either aphids or whiteflies, or maybe it was whiteflies who were doing this. But my point being is that it turned on the defenses for a totally different pest and not for itself. So in that way, it can be sort of funny to consider two pests kind of going at it indirectly like that.
Well, it also makes you wonder how many cannabinoid or chemovar profiles are actually a result of a virus or some other secondary infection and not actually the regular expression, and it would make a lot of sense why you have such radical differences in chemovar expression given the region, because the viral expression would be radically different.
Not only viruses, but also, like, yeah, absolutely, endophytes.
Yeah,
or organisms that are just living kind of, as far as we can tell anyways, neutrally. But, you know, the vast majority of microbes are not culturable. So it's a wild, wild world out there, and we're not really, you know, we're only seeing through it like you would look out of a window. We don't really have the whole picture. But with the right angles, we can get a good perspective, I suppose. Maybe build a few more windows.
Well, I mean, it's a great reason to have a microscope and be able to look through your own window to your own grow, right? Because there's no substitute to observing the grow environment that your plant is growing in, or the plant itself, right? I mean, that's ultimately, we can't always, like, measure everything in comparison to someone else that, you know, might not be growing in anywhere close to the same environment, and obviously not an identical one. And sometimes now, with the beauty of technology, they might be on the other side of the globe, you know, growing completely different genetics. And sometimes I feel like we put too much comparison in what we're trying to do. Like, even though there may be similarities we can draw from it, I feel like we take it too far sometimes.
I think the similarities would be the fact that we have good grow techniques, but environments create different objectives or problems, you know.
Yeah, well, I do think that indoors you probably have, you know, maybe some more consistency that can be created across the world. But outdoors, it's like he's talking about, that, you know, there's a metric fuckton of microbes that you can't culture or observe, and we find and identify different ones all the time. So and those different mixtures and combinations, we know that trigger different responses from the genetics of the plant and people growing from different seeds. There's just a certain amount of observing your own grows and your own environments that just, in my opinion, gives you more accurate data than going out and comparing to the web.
So have you seen any other viruses? When I was just out in Oregon, and I saw an Anheuser-Busch hemp field. Yes, that's a real thing. That was next to a soybean field, and they were ravaged pretty hardcore by a leaf curl virus that supposedly was transferred by leaf hoppers. From the soybeans to the hemp, And that was the first time I had ever seen that. I got some good documentation pictures, and there was both a mosaic virus and a leaf curl that were being attributed to pest transfer from soybeans.
That was the question I was going to ask. If you have a vermin or a bug with a virus and it takes a bite into your plant, and it's infected with the virus, what happens inside the plant, and does it affect the entire plant, or is there places where xylem and phloem don't reach the plant, and are those areas safe, or can you kind of tell us about how that works?
Or does the virus affect the plant at all?
It entirely depends on the virus and the viral load and what other microbials are exposed to that. I mean, there's quite a bit of documentation. I know Kevin Jodry talked about it, and a couple of other Alan from GrowCosh, he talked about it on the labs suppressing viral load and many different types of viruses, including that the hop latent virus, and using that to clean strains from that hop latent virus. So, there's some documentation for that, but a lot of these new viruses, we're only just seeing cross-crop transfer for the first time in the last 1 to 3 years, and there's just no documentation.
That was really helpful right there, what you said about microbial load, and it depends on whether or not the virus is transmitted persistently or semi-persistently, and even that is sort of a contentious way to characterize it. We don't even know what part of the insect specifically, where I think it's in the case of semi-persistent virus transmission. It's usually in the front part, usually in the salivary gland area, but sometimes things are kept in the midgut, sometimes things are in the hindgut, sometimes like with aphids, for example, aphids are the biggest vector of viruses, of phytoviruses, anyways. And they also have a really inseparable relationship with microbes. Many of these microbes are important. They're integral to their ability to feed on phloem, for example. They live in special fat cells called bacteriocytes. And if those bacteria are killed, then the aphid will die right afterwards. And so it's interesting to consider what the ramifications of certain microbial interactions are, even inside its own host. With viruses, most people don't know this, but malaria, for example, the plasmodium that causes malaria, it's not great for the mosquito either. The mosquito's not chilling out, getting bad guy points. I keep bringing this up, but for so many people, there's this, in my opinion, incorrect way to look at pest management. And it's very antagonistic, and it doesn't really, I think, do justice to the sheer nuance and complexity of ecological interactions. And, there are no bad guys and good guys. I'm sure you guys know. It's just that, sometimes things work out where one's a vector for the other, but it might really perform better even if it didn't have that virus, swimming around in its gut.
Well, for instance, Fusarium and Botrytis both are endophytes that are perfectly fine to be there in the right levels and with the right species, but when the ratio goes off, it starts mauling the plant. And there's a lot of documentation depending on the species on that. That was one of the things that really blew me away when I was really learning about endophytes, was a lot of the species that I've traditionally thought of as pathogens actually are present in the plant tissue all the time.
Absolutely. I just did a video on my channel about endophytes in grapes and how, there were just so many different families represented. It was interesting for me to mull over which bacterial and fungal, there are even what are called endohyphal bacteria. So, people talk in cannabis spaces and polyculture spaces about whether it's better to have a bacterially dominated soil or a fungally dominated soil. But You know, like if you have endohyphal bacteria in your fungi, do you count that in the bacteria or do you count that in the fungi? Like it, in some cases it gets to the point where it's like that song where there's like, there's a toad on a log, there's a bump on a toad on a log in the middle of the swamp. You know, it just, it turtles all the way down, to use a meme phrase.
But you also have to go into the fact that, you know, there, like you said, there's good and bad. So if it's a, if it, again, it, yeah, we're really delving into the spongy and the microbial end of it now more than ever. So wouldn't you agree with that, though? Because you said there was, well, you kind of said, well, there's really not anything bad, but we do look at there's good and bad.
We do have to look at it. You know, we do have to simplify it a little bit. I'm not trying to, like, backpedal, I guess, but it's right. Like, you know, at some point we do have to draw a line, and what's good or bad for a cultivator is on a spectrum. Symbiosis is a spectrum. You have organisms that can, you know, in the same generation or the same individual can go from being parasitic or pathogenic to being beneficial based on this environment, based on other microbes present, like you were talking about earlier about endophytes or whomever it was. But I guess I mean you all. But at the same time, over generations and over, like, evolutionary pressures, like, an organism that's beneficial absolutely can go and become more commensalic and even free-living in some cases where it wasn't before, or go from free-living to becoming an obligate pathogen and then possibly even becoming a symbiont. That happens a lot, too. And when that happens, a lot of bacteria, or a lot of, not bacteria, but organisms that are symbiotic in this way, they their genome becomes reduced. It's very common for this to happen. And it's because, and oftentimes processes that they used to do internally become sort of outsourced to the physiology of the host or to other microbes in the organism. It's pretty fascinating to me how that sort of thing happens.
Thank you. Thanks.
Oh, yeah. So for people, maybe to roll back a little bit, for people that aren't aware, what how do people tell if they have a viral infection in their plants and not an insect or a deficiency? I think that's maybe a good question to ask. Are you there?
Matthew?
Oh, sorry about that. I guess my mic was off. I was saying that it definitely depends on the virus, like you were saying before. Certain viruses have certain symptoms. Some viruses have no symptoms, like the cannabis cryptic virus, which I did a video on. Then you also have phytoplasmas, which are like a special kind of bacteria that are also transmitted by leafhoppers, and they cause like what's called witch's brooming, which is found in other plants too for phytoplasmas, and they cause like really weird chaotic growth and weird growth. I'm sure you guys have seen cannabis cultivars like on social media perhaps, where people are like, "Wow, dude, look at this!" And it's like a fasciated, you know, plant, and the stem's all flat and the flower is like bilaterally symmetrical or whatever, or unilaterally. That's cool, but that's also caused by a genetic issue. That can be caused by just it being polyploid. It can be caused by a pathogen or hormone imbalance. And you really don't know unless you do like an analysis. And I think there was another question that was asked, like, what can they do to assess that? And what they can do, in some places anyways, and your mileage may vary. I don't know every state and every province of the world, but if you can get, like, somebody to do, like, a bioassay, particularly, like, if you do suspect it to be a virus, you could possibly get a plant virologist to do it. And in places where maybe hemp is legal, there might be precedent to have, like, your local university extension come out and take a look. I'm sure somebody would love to write a paper about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yep, your local. I always tell people that, you know, they ask, how do I do this? I say, well, don't ask me. ask your local county agent, and that would lead to your local extension university that does agriculture.
So tell us more about this cryptic virus you're talking about.
Sure. So the cannabis cryptic virus is it gets its name because it's cryptic. There are no real symptoms to it. It's passable vertically, so from parent to offspring, and it can be passed both from a male's pollen getting into a female and then passing it that way, or it can be from a female being infected and bearing the seeds. In both cases, it can be passable this way, which is kind of like the ultimate evolutionary like jackpot, right? Because then you guarantee that your progeny has a host in that way. It's a lot more rare than people might think.
Like if anything survives, you survive, right? I mean, either you're killing everything, or I'm coming with, basically. Right?
Basically, right? And that's how that symbiosis happens too, because over time, mutations occur and that sort of a thing, and then you become stuck with your host, and then maybe you perform a function, that doesn't even matter until like this a new organism comes in and decides to like eat you, and oh no, like turns out the virus infects like a microbe in its gut and kills it, like, and that would confer a huge fitness advantage, and that's how that happens. I mean, that's one of the ways it happens, at least.
So we have, like, beneficial microbes in the way of, like, fungi and bacteria. Has there ever been a beneficial virus?
I only know of one example, and what was it called? It's in the cannabis cryptic virus. It's funny you mention that, because it was actually in the cannabis cryptic virus video where I mentioned it. Because it was somewhat related. I think it was in the same family. I think it was Partitiviridae. But anyways, my point is that they found that it was a virus of white clover. I think it's called like white clover virus 1 or something.
Is this the one that gave it THC?
No. I believe that what you're referring to was some genetic material that's left over from like an ancient sort of like for example, in our DNA, like about 1 to 1.5 or 2% of our DNA is viral from long, long way before we became, species as great apes.
Right.
The ARC genes are important for our short-term memory, for example. And those were from viruses long, 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 long time ago.
So wasn't there an article not that long ago that talked about that the presence of THC in cannabis was the result of a viral infection like you're talking about millions of years ago or whatever?
Not only is THC in cannabinoid synthesis a result of a viral infection, the fact that we have boys and girls of anything, the genes responsible for making a creature both male or female has also been linked to viral DNA.
Oh, so like separate, you mean, as opposed to like...
The ability to exchange DNA in that male-female construct,
the ability to be hermaphroditic.
No, not hermaphroditic. Mm-hmm. Like having male, being a boy or a girl, going from being asexual to sexual.
You could even go further and say that like pathogens, like for example the defense pathways of plants is like ancient. There's been evolution and there's updates to that system, but selection pressures from back before plants were no more than like algal like predecessors in the oceans, in the primordial oceans, interactions and selection pressures from pathogens and other microbes started there. Certainly the same could be said for, the most primordial organisms that, eventually became eukaryotes and everything after.
Absolutely.
I've got a question real quick, just a quick one, because the question was kind of general, even though we're talking about cannabis and plants and agriculture, but is polio a virus or not?
The polio virus, yeah.
So it does have, it actually has been proven lately, and that's another, that probably another show, but it has been proven to kill brain tumors and stuff like that. And then, you know, where people, you know, it actually, it was attacked by your immune system and killed the, well, it killed the tumors. And then they use Avastin to allow it to be killed, which is a whole nother story. But I just wanted to, just for the answer to the general question of are there any viral, you know, anything viral that is positive? Polio vaccine's been used to kill brain tumors.
There's viruses in your digestive tract as well that have been, you know, symbiotically documented, I guess.
Yeah, and I totally interrupted you there too. So you were talking about the other one, the other example you talked about in your video, and I interrupted you there. So if you want to recap on that, sorry for sidetracking you so much.
No, that's okay. I thought the questions were really cool. I really enjoy talking about heady topics like this. Just to kind of sum up what we were just talking about. Yeah, there's definitely interactions that are, like, not obvious at first, and perhaps are even novel, first time we've ever, like, observed them, and possibly the first time they've even occurred, where they had beneficial effects. And you know, it's like, maybe it's only, like, a select, like, population of a certain microbe, or under very specific conditions does this happen. You know, it's kind of like with science, when we, like, do things with, like, really extreme temperature, or really extreme gravity, or really extreme magnetism, like the laws of physics start to like change in a vacuum in a very, in very small, like when we do it in a very small space, but like, though, you know, you can't really necessarily do those things in mass. And similarly, this is the case, like biologically, you know, things can happen sort of uniquely like that in small situations, but they might not ever expand out unless they're really ecologically fit for some reason or another. But cannabis cryptic virus, again, here's the cool thing about that that's relevant is that the research report that I read about them, or the two that I read about it, seems to imply that it's possible that the cannabis cryptic virus was actually originally, long time ago, a pathogen of, or maybe just a microbe that existed inside of a fungal pathogen. And that fungal pathogen infecting cannabis or its ancestors, it's a little bit ambiguous when talking in this way, that perhaps over time, you know, this sort of pathogenic interaction kind of allowed the virus to move hosts, and that perhaps due to some sort of weird event or circumstance, this movement, you know, kind of like kept the virus in the plant, and it didn't really have very much effect on it, but here it is. And because they didn't think that it was transmitted when they by a pest or anything like that. It seemed to just only transmit vertically and not horizontally, really. And I mean, you know, the amount of research on this is still kind of lacking at this point. But I just found that kind of fascinating concept, just like in general, right?
For sure. Man, that's awesome.
That's really cool.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve. Sorry.
Go ahead, Jay.
I just think it's crazy that a virus can interject DNA into our species and change maybe certain aspects of our physiology just from its influence.
I mean, it's really kind of cool. I think it's really fascinating. It is pretty crazy, right? Like,
yeah.
With microbes. Like, oh, sorry.
Well, wait a minute. It's got its own DNA and all, right? So, I mean, anything that's introduced to your body could change your body.
Can't change your code though, your DNA code.
Not gonna change your DNA, no. No, very few things have their ability to incorporate into your DNA and then use.
Now, I was saying that even a virus has a DNA code, right?
Yeah, but it's not gonna incorporate itself into your
DNA
because you don't get the flu or like some other thing automatically. Like
yeah, but things are stored in your fatty acid and stuff like that.
Well, like even us as humans, like we require a whole shitload of equipment just to be able to modify DNA. So it's not like, you know, it's like.
I'll yield on the DNA statement. I'm just talking about that anytime anything's introduced to your body, it could have a lasting effect, be stored in your fatty tissue or whatever.
That's a good point. I mean, like, you know, like the chemistry of something, like some people are, you know, and some people, their sensitivity is on a spectrum too. Like, you know, some people are allergic to things that other people aren't, for example, and like your statement about like with viruses, like microbes in general, like some of them have like plasmids and stuff, and they're able to, they need to inject genetic code in order to populate themselves, like with viruses, or like even mycorrhizae, like when they interact with their hosts, they have and I always use this term, a three-handed handshake, or a three-way handshake rather. You know, where like the plant produces compounds that signal for the microbe, oh, hey, this is a host, go, you know, and maybe it moves towards the plant, and then it exudes compounds and what are called mic factors if they're mycorrhizae, and if they're rhizobia, if they're like bacteria that fix nitrogen in legumes, then they do nod factors. And there's this like very sophisticated and nuanced like genetic like modification, like alteration of the surface level structures of the plant. And that kind of stuff is really amazing to me. I often characterize it like, you know, because plants have what's called an innate immune system, and I like to call that immune system 1.0. Doesn't mean it's bad. It's still very sophisticated, but they lack things that things with an adaptive immune system have. Like humans, like white blood cells, for example. But instead of having their own white blood cells that they produce endogenously, they have mercenaries do it. They out-contract for that. They have microbes come in, and so do we. But, like, yeah, it's, you know, it's white blood cells for hire. Or they do a bunch of other sorts of things that are useful for the plant.
That's really cool. There's so many different things that we're still learning about, and then that doesn't even take into account endophytes and all the things that they do and how they alter the plant's DNA and everything else, and that's a whole other rabbit hole.
Well, Steve, weren't you talking about just a couple, maybe a few shows ago? Fuck, I don't remember. They all kind of run together. There's been a lot of them now. But you were talking about like exposing different cultivars to produce like higher levels of certain cannabinoids or terpenes, you know, and like exposing
CBG and all. Yeah.
Mike West was talking about increasing CBL levels through the intentional infection of powdery mildew, which I thought was completely insane but really cool.
Oh yeah, that was really awesome when he was talking about how that turned out. There was an accident, but they tested it and they found it. And as we discussed, there's even CBs and levels of that we still haven't even found yet, or found a way to find them. Right. So.
Yeah, I mean, like that's probably my favorite like aspect of research right now with regards to like. IPM and other integrated pest management facets that have to do with that sort of interaction, because like whether it's the formulation of like a natural chemistry that we want to use, or like whether it's understanding that like we mentioned symbiosis and like viruses and benefits and detriments, but like for example in the P. aphid, so the P. aphid has the ability to harvest solar energy. Not quite the same as photosynthesis, but it is able to harvest solar energy and make it usable as cellular energy. And it's able to do this due to having virus viral DNA from like an ancient interaction a long, long time ago. It has this really cool ability, and it can also biosynthesize carotenoids, which not a lot of animals can do, if I remember right. But what it also has are bacteria, and some of those bacteria are beneficial, and a subset of those bacteria have themselves a particular, what's it called? P-aphid, APSE or something like that. And it's like a particular symbiont that is able to kill parasitic wasp eggs. So when this parasitic wasp comes in and lays an egg in the aphid, there's a symbiont that kills that egg, like 60% of the time. And, like, you know, it's just like people don't know that. And, you know, you'll get, like, in my case as a professional, like, you'll get upset, or you won't know, like, man, why are these wasps not working? They work every other situation. What's going on? And, you know, we wouldn't know that if we didn't do that research. And it's just one of those really nuanced things that you either know or you don't, and you couldn't possibly know it if you didn't, like, look at its, like, genome or something.
So you're saying you apply it and it doesn't do the job as much because of this other situation, you know, the other, you know what I'm saying?
Bacteria. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So because this population, and aphids are, they typically clonally reproduce, at least for all of their life or for most of their life. And, so these bacteria are just passed into their clones. You know, it's essentially the same, like, it's functionally the same as, like, having, like, a genetic modification that modulates their genes, because essentially that's what happens. It has its own genome, and, or like the mitochondria in the cell, right? Like, you know, it's the mitochondria have their own DNA, and that's because of it's believed that mitochondria were a free living microbe, you know, millions of years ago, and they became symbiotic with our, you know, unicellular ancestors, and they caused the organism to outperform others, and here we are still with them after all this time.
Dude, that's really wild to me. That's really wild. I think that's even crazier that we could have the course of our evolution changed dramatically by the influence of these microbes that could completely change the way our species looks, talks, feels, and everything. Just blows my mind.
Well, you've heard of toxoplasmosis.
I think that's called an evolution.
You've heard of Toxoplasmosis gondii?
No.
Yes, yes, the crazy cat lady virus.
Bacteria, but yeah.
Oh, sorry, bacteria.
I have heard of that fly that has something, a virus or something that lands on it and then controls the fly. I heard of that one.
What's the crazy cat lady bacteria?
Yeah, that was a joke.
Yeah, so it's this bacteria, and it's in cats. And it's ironic, it's funny to think about when you consider how much cats are like a meme and people have loved them for so long. And I mean, it's thought that cats had a beneficial effect for keeping, like, other pests, a symbiosis, you know, from eating our food stores and that kind of a thing. And, you know, the populations would tolerate each other and, you know, adaptation happened. And that's how that went. But, these bacteria, what they do is they can populate in other mammals, but I think they can only reproduce in cats. And so they have this great way of, and it's not totally understood all the way, but basically they can rewrite or otherwise heavily manipulate the behavior of, like, for example, rats to, like, not fear or possibly even be attracted to, like, signals of cats, like their urine. So then that cat kills that rat, and then the bacteria gets into the animal because it eats it. And then, you know, you have a great happy ending for the bacteria. But my point is that, so us as mammals, sorry, I didn't put the important part, I left you hanging with the detail. So for people, crazy cat lady, right, the idea that maybe people also were infected by this bacteria, it's thought that very many people are, and for some people, maybe the symptoms are mild, and, you know, in a lot of cases, it's hard to really say if somebody's being, like, mentally affected by this bacteria, but, you know, signs seem to point to probably...
Or just at least to make sure I'm following this. So the suggestion being that the bacteria is continually produced by the cats, populated to the human, being the crazy cat lady, who's being controlled by the bacteria.
To like cats.
Yeah, at least
to like
the
more cats, the more, get more cats and buy shit for cats or whatever.
So this, I goes, mean, like, this goes back to the fact that schizophrenia, so people that are schizophrenic, have like an 80%+ chance to be infected with the Toxoplasmosis goldii, and which is really weird. And then you also have the fact that in some populations in some cities, it's as high as almost 90% infection rate with Toxoplasmosis across the entire population. So they've done quite a few studies, especially directly linking it to schizophrenia, or at least increased chance of schizophrenia.
And here's the part where I make a whole bunch of enemies, because, like, as somebody who loves the world and the environment and ecology, I have to point out that, like, here's the other thing. Cats kill a whole lot of natural organisms, like a ton, like millions per year, domesticated cats, I mean. And especially in, like, the Americas, where there's no, like, analog to their, like, niche, their ecological niche. There's no, like, there's bobcats and things, but it's different. Different, like, weight class, different, like, trophic level, different prey. They go after more things, I should say. And so, like, bringing them over as mousers served a great purpose for humans. It helped with disease control and pest problems with rats, but it also is killing a lot of insects, for example, and a lot of other small fauna.
So let's talk more about insects. You cover a lot of really awesome insect content. What are some of the other really interesting videos you've done, and maybe more enlightening videos that you've done on different insects on cannabis?
Sure. So I recently finished a video on Forodon cannabis, the cannabis aphid. And in it, because there's not a lot of information on it for obvious reasons. The next best thing that I could do was to give all the information I had on the cannabis aphid that's actually about the cannabis aphid, and there's not much, and then kind of make some speculation about what are some other abilities that it might have based on its closest relative, which I surmise to be the hops aphid. And part of that's because cannabis and humulus hops are the most in the 10 genera of cannabis, of the cannabaceae, I should say. Of the 10 genera in the family cannabaceae, humulus and cannabis are the closest together based on phylogenetic studies. And so, perhaps unsurprisingly, Forodon, the genus of aphid, we have Forodon humuli, which is the hops aphid, or the hop aphid, and we have Forodon cannabis of cannabis. And Forodon humuli feeds on two main hosts, hops and prunus species, so like stone fruits, like nectarines and that kind of a thing. And they host alternate. Forodon cannabis, as far as we know, doesn't. And so, but we know that, like, physiologically, because they come from the same genus, they probably have a lot of similarities, you know. And so one of them is, like, for Forodon humuli, when they migrate, they have a sensitivity to, like, beta-caryophyllene. And they use that to, kind of home in on their hops targets for a population dispersal when they're up in the air. And so perhaps this might also ring true for Forodon cannabis, because they probably have pretty similar physiologies, and they probably have, see, aphids and a lot of other insects, when it comes to, like, pheromones and chemical signaling, A lot of things are conserved. So, like, you know, if you have a chemical compound that's a volatile and it stimulates one species, it might have overlap with other species in the same genus or family with other sometimes multiple species that are, like, you know, kind of at two ends, like, of the family. Like, one of them's way more primitive and one of them's way more modern evolutionarily, but they might still have very similar base chemical reactions, if that makes sense. So anyways, that video was really interesting. I really liked that video because I got to talk about the sort of speciation event of cannabis, because I thought that was a really important thing to mention. I wasn't going to say this sort of speculatory thing without, like, evidence that kind of, like, lends itself. You know what I mean?
I'm convinced, after all the consulting I've done, there's at least two different species that are really hitting cannabis hard, because I've seen the bong aphids, which I think is the species you're referring to.
It is.
And they have those two little horns on their butt.
Well, most aphids have cornicles.
Yeah.
But all Forodon, but also Forodon cannabis and Forodon humuli, they both have these antennal tubercles, they're called. And they're situated on the antennae. And they kind of look like little trichomes. In my video, I mentioned those as well, so that people can, like, watch out for them, because it's one of the only sort of, like, semi-diagnostic characteristics. Of course, you know, we've never documented hops aphid on cannabis, so you can make that sort of contextual point. But technically, if a hops aphid were to adapt, because aphids are great at adapting, I guess technically then you wouldn't be able to tell the difference by physical visuals. You'd have to mount it.
In Colorado, I've seen one that doesn't have those on the abdomen. And it's
there are some that don't.
Yeah, so this one looks, even the nymphs, like, all life stages look different with this one. I've gotten good pictures. I sent some alcohol samples over to Susan Wainwright Evans. I don't know whatever happened with that, but she has some.
Oh, yeah, no, and I'm just in case I'm just, like, totally make myself look uncredible or whatever. If I said all aphids do, I should have said most aphids do, because you're totally right. There are some aphids where, instead of having, like, cornicles that are, like, projections, they're kind of just, like, pores. So they've, like, kind of lost the projection. Or maybe they never developed it. I don't know which one came first in their evolutionary history, to be honest. Maybe nobody does, for that matter. But, yeah, it's really cool. There's also the rice root aphid, Rhopalocyphum rufi abdominale, and it's originally from Japan, and kind of like the hops aphid I mentioned earlier, which has, like, a holocyclic, or like a two sort of host life cycle, the rice root aphid does as well, but mostly in its native territory, where in which it goes from, like, grains, like rice, to also Prunus species, which is an interesting thing to consider. And so the rice root aphid in Europe, and also in indoor cultivation facilities, it doesn't tend to have this problem. And it's thought that this is because of an adaptation to just, like, being totally clonal. Sometimes insect populations, they'll just, especially if they have a tendency towards parthenogenesis, then they'll have populations that are just asexual. There's a thrips species that is like that, the onion thrips. There's like a sexual population, and there's a couple of those, and there's an asexual population that's pretty prominent. And it's interesting because it's not the typical kind of parthenogenesis where a female will make, like, a female that's unfertilized will make a male, mate with that male, and then make males. It's like the reverse. So, like, there's one where they make females if they are unfertilized, and only if they're fertilized, they'll make males again. So that's how the sort of the clonal reproduction started with them. And it's thought that a symbiont, Wolbachia, which is in a lot of insects actually, and typically modifies their sexual characteristics to be asexual. This is a common thing that happens in Wolbachia infections, actually. That's thought to be what happened with the thrips. So, you know, symbiosis, right?
So what other insects, aside from the aphids, have you done, are found to be pretty unique? It's interesting, you talked about onion thrips. A lot of people don't know that onion thrips are really the one that attacks cannabis, not Western flower thrips, which is often published.
I mean, I've seen Western flower thrips on cannabis myself, but you're right to say that, like, it's not enough to just say it is Western flower thrips or it is any other species. Like, you have to, you want somebody to, like, take a look. If you're unsure, sometimes you know from the markings. Like, I've seen bean thrips on cannabis, for example, and when I was up in Humboldt, I saw orothrips, which is not typically a pest, but it's usually on oak, and I saw those on cannabis, and that was kind of fascinating.
That's interesting. I've never heard of that.
Yeah, they have this like black-white coloration, so it makes them pretty conspicuous. They're not the only species that does, though. But
a lot of people don't know that about 34% of thrips are actually predatory. And if you see thrips and you have spider mites, a lot of times the thrips will feed on the spider mites as well, depending on the species.
Actually, yeah, you're totally right. Western flower thrips is actually omnivorous. A lot of people don't know that. They will feed on predatory mite eggs even. And predatory mites will... Like, if they sense the chemicals that come off of their thrips predator or their thrips prey, then they don't necessarily oviposit in the same way. Because, especially for predatory mites that are omnivorous themselves and feed on pollen, where they might normally lay their eggs near pollen, they will not, because they know that thrips will feed on the pollen and may also feed on their eggs. Western flower thrips will even feed on, and we were talking about like competitiveness earlier in the podcast, they'll feed on spider mite eggs too. There was a really cool study that talked about this behavior because what the researchers did, I think it was this guy named Saito, he cut the webbing away and he let the Western flower thrips, I believe, just kind of go ham, and they totally fed on the eggs. So without that webbing, the spider mites would actually be getting eaten by thrips, believe it or not.
I got a question. You know, because we talk about preventative and predator mites and predator insects and all the time. So what, if you decided you wanted to do, would you call it the Western flower, would you call it the...
You wouldn't introduce those to get rid of mites. They're just...
No, but to introduce it, all right, let me just make it basic. My basic question is, if you keep introducing predator insects into your environment over and over, or as a proactive measure, is that a good or a bad idea?
Totally contextual, but generally I would say, yeah, like, that can be expensive. From a holistic standpoint, it might not be the smartest move to use like bulk releases. There are products out there where you can use sort of a slow release of like predatory mites, for example, that like lasts over weeks. Applying them preventatively is almost always like the best option, like for a lot of pests, like thrips, for example, for broad mites. In my experience, for broad mites and for russet mites, this is particularly true. I had a client in Northern California. We set up an IPM strategy in which he would apply Amblyopsis swirskii, which is a type 3B predatory mite. And if you want, I can go over what that means. It feeds on pollen and a bunch of other insect pests, whereas like persimilis mites are what are called a type 1A. Which means they're specialists. So the closer you are to the earlier the smaller number, the more specialized you are in Tetranychus on spider mites. And the more further you are out to like the 3 and the 4, the more of a generalist you are. And so Emblesius swirskii is a type 3B. And the B means that it likes glabrous or smooth leaves. It does not like really trichomous stems. In fact, they do more poorly on tomato cultivars that are really hairy, really trichomous, because the trichomes are equal opportunity killers. And over time, they just build up these toxins on their bodies as they walk along them and they die. Even the non-glandular trichomes. Yeah, so anyways, he was using these sachets of swirskii to preventively treat western flower thrips and other thrips, broad mites, russet mites, white flies. He wasn't getting all of these, but he wanted to prevent them. And it was economically viable for him to do this, but he slipped up. He didn't go on the regimen, and he let the sachets he didn't put out the sachets like for a couple of weeks longer than he should have, and he got some russet mites, and they just kind of came in. But so there's obviously kind of like an ambient russet mite population in his area, probably because it's a big cultivation space for cannabis. And russet mites and other small organisms that get caught up on the wind as aeroplankton, and then they kind of travel the airscape, and then they fall down and, you know, hopefully onto what they need to. Russet mites, Areophyidae in particular, are really adapted to doing this. There's like over 5,000 species of russet mites, and a bunch of them were found simply by putting out like dish trays of water and then like putting them on skyscrapers and catching them as they fell out of the atmosphere. So it's literally raining bugs a lot more than people think. And so these predatory mites, he got back on the schedule and they went away. He used a few bulk releases of the predatory mites to kind of get them in check, and then he started applying the sachets, and now they're doing well. So yeah, having a proactive population is good.
So what is your go-to for russets?
These predatory mites, Emblesius swirskii. My go-to for russets is to preventively apply biocontrols if you can afford to do so. Usually as sachets, usually depending on the distributor. It's not always like accurate what the distributor says, how long the packets will last you, because it's really dependent on your environment. If it's hotter or more humid or there's other factors, then it might cause the mites to like get out of the packet faster or something. So I usually like to keep it really tight at like 6 weeks. Like some people say 8 weeks, some people say theirs last for 10 weeks. I like to say 6 weeks because, you know, it's worth your time. You know, if you save one or two plants, like it basically pays for itself in cannabis terms anyways. So it's usually worth it to do that. And then they'll also feed on pollen. And so if you grow like ornamental peppers, or if you companion plant with other plants that produce a lot of pollen, there's great research that shows Amblesius swirskii and other predatory type 3 mites, like Neocilius cucumeris is another one. They'll feed on the pollen and they'll reproduce and they'll be very fecund. And you'll get like, in my experience and even in research reports, I've definitely observed like a 3 times or even like a 4 times increase in population simply because of the pollen production that they're able to eat. Because see, females, they have to really wrangle their prey. When you think about it, they're like the same size. So it's like a tiger going after, like usually predators play it safe. They don't usually go after a fair fight because that's what suckers do. That's a great way to get injured and die. Using technical like metaphors here, but like when the females don't have to do that, they can just gorge themselves on proteinaceous pollen and they can totally feed off of that and reproduce. But their best diet is on a mixture of both. So they'll feed a bunch on pollen and then they'll get the physiological desire to go out and get a blood meal, and then they will kind of have the best of both worlds. Meanwhile, you have a larger army to be garrisoned in your plans.
Does this equate at all to like with ladybugs? Say you release ladybugs, and they leave if there's nothing to eat. So what you're saying is that this would be a predator that, you know, if you understand where I'm getting at here, that has other sources of a way to stick around. So if you companion plant with a certain pollen producing other, you know, companion plants. So, you know, I'm sorry to be redundant, but I think you would know what I'm asking.
I think so. Yeah, there's like definitely you can apply other biocontrol agents preventatively. The thing is that it's even more expensive if you can't like keep them sustained in your if you're doing it weekly. Like, that's a lot of money. Like, there's a floriculturalist I've worked with, and, you know, their biocontrol, yeah, like, their IPM biocontrol, like, cost per year was, like, $100,000 for, like, 8.5 acres or so of cut flowers. So that was egregious, and we were able to bring that down, by like being more strategic with the usage and, you know, kind of putting more out when we knew the seasonal. So that's why crop scouting is so important. Like, if you don't check your plants, if you don't record your pests, if you don't know what they are, and especially if you don't record when they come up and you don't have that like on some sort of a platform that's easy for you to reference, like paper is fine, but you're probably not going to go through the files, and like it's really hard to put it all together. But if you have like an app or something, then you know, it can be way more concise, and then you can see these patterns, and you'll know like, oh, it's summer, or you'll know because other people are dealing with it, or you've grown for so long, you know. But like having the data for your specific location and not making generalizations is usually worth the money.
I think I was more getting at how you could keep your predators there on your property without leaving, you know, is what I was getting at, kind of thing, you know, because like we know ladybugs and praying mantis, if you no longer have any pests, they go find pests.
So like a banker plant is more banker, like what you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, well, I thought that's what Matthew was talking about earlier too, where you have other plants that produce pollen so that these particular predators want to stay around and eat pollen, or that's what I was trying to make the connection to.
Yeah, I think if I was following, I don't follow everything he says because I'm a computer guy, so some of this is over my head. But what I think he was just talking about, the fact that they do eat both and that they might prefer different things when reproducing. But what you're saying is that it's kind of the idea of what we were talking about before is like banker plants, where you grow plants that produce pollen that they can eat so that they can, their population can stay up, essentially.
Absolutely. And yeah, so it's definitely related. Like I was talking about peppers as like a banker plant.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, pretty much, and like I also made a video. So I've made videos about Phytoceidae, which is one family of predatory mites. It encompasses most of the predatory mites that live on the plants, anyways, on the foliage that are commercially available. And they go from type 1 to type 2 to type 3 to type 4. And I've made videos that kind of explain what the different types are, and I've made videos about explaining different relationships and sort of nuanced things like how different pollen, get this, different pollen, the phenols and the like the polyphenols and the other sorts of incidental pigmentation compounds in pollen will actually benefit the predatory mites by kind of acting as like a UV sunscreen. And a lot of these predatory mites are either blind or basically blind functionally. And so, you know, they don't like the sunlight. That's one of the things that they can detect a lot of the time, or they have a very simple physiology. And so Like if it gets too dry, then their eggs will die, or if it gets too dry, then they will die. And so having the right microclimate is important. But also, like, if you're able to give them prophylactic pollen that benefits their UV protection, then they might be able to do better in sunnier conditions. And if they're already adapted to that area and then you give them even better food source, then they'll do that much better. And, like, those are the little bits of esoterica that I really find fascinating. And it's not, like, a complex topic. Like, you know, you can just say, like, give them good pollen and they'll perform better because of this reason without getting into all the technicalities. But, like, most people don't know it because they don't know to look for it and because that research is very new. And that's the kind of stuff I like to put in my videos because I think it would help the average person to know that kind of a thing.
Absolutely. I think another thing that banker plants really help with is like keeping tabs on populations, because it can be difficult to find, you know, small, fast-moving insects under a microscope if you're just kind of cruising about your grow. But if you have some banker plants that you've had in your grow for a little while that they've been able to sort of, like, you know, colonize, then it's, you know, you at least have that as a reference for a population, even if you're having a hard time finding them crawling around, especially for novices like myself.
It's definitely true. And then, like, even having different plants, like, that will change, like, your soil microbiome and your the microbes in the phylosphere and the rhizosphere, both the foliage and the soil. And, you know, so that's definitely an aspect of it, too, that we're just kind of scratching the surface about.
So what are some of the other most common insects you get asked about?
So definitely russet mites are a big one. Root aphids are a big one. The cannabis aphids getting a lot more heat. There's a lot more problems with it in California. A lot of people have been hearing about it, but it's in other parts of the United States. I think the big scare is usually, for me, root aphids or russet mites, which is probably going to be not surprising at all to anyone in the audience. Whiteflies, for a long time, and perhaps recently, I think it will change because of the revelation I mentioned earlier about the leaf, the lettuce chlorosis virus that transmits to cannabis. Whiteflies weren't really a huge problem in my experience. You know, I only have a section of the people who I talk to who cultivate cannabis, right? A very small fraction. And that's a huge ornamentals pest, a huge residential pest. So it wouldn't surprise me that it would become more of a problem in cannabis, partly because it's pretty much everywhere, and partly because biosecurity practices. I mean, one of you mentioned that you do computers, and so, like, if you do any information security or IT or whatever, I know that, like, security through obscurity is the worst kind of security, for one, and for another, like, you know, like, my understanding is that the better your security, the worse the user interface is, generally speaking, because things that are naturally easy are going to be easier to exploit. And the same is true for biosecurity.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, and, you know, like, similarities is, you know, sort of what, you know, brought me to aquaponics, is having a, you know, like, a different outlet that wasn't, like, you know, monitor output, basically, you know, in interacting more with nature. But yeah, you know, it's absolutely true that the simpler that you make the interface for the user, the easier it is to duplicate the interaction. And that's really, you know, there has to be a certain level of complexity. So meeting it, you know, sort of requires creativity, you know, like finding a user interface that's complex enough to be secure but still usable is really
kind of, you know, the problem that you're trying to solve in software all the time anyway. And really across the board, like even in like, you know, whether you're talking about like VPNs or remote access or, you know, logging in to check your email at work or preventing someone to log in and check their email at work, you know, like all of those things come into play all the time.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, I think it's both of those things that makes both of those topics, something I really like. I really enjoy, learning about physical security and also, you know, digital security. And I find that the metaphors are very, very parallel because fundamentally we're talking about, in the abstract, we're talking about access and influence, essentially, right? And so whether we're talking about symbioses or whether we're talking about actual computer viruses or a Trojan or an exploit, you know, plant pathogens produce or pests for that matter. I mean, if you're a big computer person, there's a ton of parallels. It'd be really easy for you to see, not you in particular, but for the universal you, to see those parallels. Like, you know, an aphid will be sucking on a plant, you know, it'll in its saliva, it'll have toxins that it produces, and those toxins will have, some of them will be like phytohormones, and they'll cause the plant to curl in on itself, and the leaves will curl. Not all aphids do this, and not all aphids have the same effect on different plants because they have a different operating system, right? And so, you know, the plants that curl over, well, they might produce a pseudogall, it's called. And that pseudogall, well, it only creates like a little aperture for the aphid to get in and out, and ladybugs might not be able to get in and eat them. And so that confers a benefit, you know, and that's going to be conserved.
It's like the hacking process, basically. You know, it's like the – you know, if you want to look at it on a networking sort of metaphor, it's kind of, you know, if you look at the, you know, again, not, I don't want to label them the bad guys, but if you look at the aphids as, you know, essentially the hackers that are trying to get in, right? That's what they're, you know, ultimately trying to do. They're not trying to curl your leaves. They just want to eat, you know, like it's not, you know. It's
yeah,
not,
but the, right, yeah, the, but I guess you could say like the genetic code that is their software.
Right,
and it's to allow them to do that.
Right, and they have to adapt in a way to be able to get in the same way, you know, you have to constantly have updates to your virus definitions on your computer because new ones come out all the time exploiting other simpler user interfaces or, you know, interfaces that haven't been patched up. And so the idea of making, you know, like making your environment as unfriendly as possible, non-user friendly, to only the stuff that you don't want in there, can be really elaborate if you want it to be that. Obviously, a lot of people don't go to that level, but if you think about it in terms of you want to put, you know, you want the "Are you sure" button to pop up before you do anything anytime you're introducing something else. And ideally, you know, just like all your ports are full with good traffic that you're already logging and, you know, there's really, like no place for anything to get in. That's still going to be your ideal situation. There is no user interface. And that's kind of the way that I look at, you know, trying to build an ecosystem and, you know, even though it takes time and it's, maybe not easy, but maintaining and keeping an ecosystem is always going to be better than allowing someone else. So the best thing that you can do for your network really is to hire the best employees that you can possibly have that are the most moral and pay them every penny that they ever want to have. And then you'll never have to change anything about any of your security other than update it against external threats that have already been documented and probably aren't after you. So that's really kind of like you want to nurture every good microbe and everything that is beneficial, not just like Google what eats russet mites once you already have russet mites. It's kind of like Googling, you know, how do I stop a hacker from taking all my money after a hacker has already taken all of your money.
Absolutely. In fact, I want to say two things because that was such a brilliant I love using the computer metaphor because so many people, I'm not going to make a value judgment about it. I think it's great that people are computer literate. I think it's an important thing for society as we go further, things get more technological. But I think that's a great metaphor. The metaphor even extends further, I think, when you consider like legacy code. Like that's what all evolution basically is. It is what genetic code is. It's legacy code. It continues to build up on itself. Sometimes there's some edits. Sometimes there's some copy errors. Sometimes there's some and I'm, of course, not the first person to make this metaphor, of course. I don't want anyone coming across or thinking that I'm coming across as, like, you know, smart for that. I'm not the first person to do it.
It's not trademarked or anything.
It's not trademarked, right? But it's definitely a good idea. It's definitely a cool metaphor.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think I wanted to say also that I forgot it. I lost it. Were you going to say something?
No, just that, you know, I totally understand what you're saying about it being outdated code. And that's the way that I look at it, is that, you know, your ecosystem has already been updated. Then hopefully if a russet mite wanders into your garden, there's already something there to eat it before it ever reproduces. And that's really the exact way that, you know, that you approach virus security, because there's no way that you can protect against viruses that aren't already known. But the best thing to do is to protect against every virus that is known and patch up every exploit and hole that exists in old code, or better yet, don't use old code.
Yeah, absolutely. And then also to not just use, to just deny the things so that, like, you can't, like, the things that would allow you to get a virus at all, or at least to suppress that. I've known a few people, and I've definitely, I really appreciate giving people the opportunity to do this for their own work staff. If their work staff grows plants, if their work staff, especially if they cultivate cannabis, you know, if you have the funds to do it, maybe, you know, when you're out ordering your biocontrol agents, maybe order a few more for your workers and give them to them and let them use them so that they don't bring anything back into you. I think the cost-benefit analysis works for that one.
You're talking about dragging stuff from your property to somebody else's property?
Yeah, well, essentially, if you're, like, buying, like, predatory mites, for example.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're going to buy them anyways. Mm-hmm. And you know that your work staff, if you know that a population of your work staff also grows cannabis and might also be liable as vectors, or they might not get a pest, but they get a pest from the cultivation facility, go back home, and then come back with it, you know, like some Galapagos Island stuff, like, you know, it might
be. It's just like, all right, so that you are kind of talking about what I thought you were talking about. Well, when we have greenhouses, yeah, for anybody out there, you know, getting into the business and going to have greenhouses, you don't just let anybody and everybody walk into your greenhouse with their clothing. In fact, like you were saying, when you said employees, you're going to hit on a operating procedure of mine. When I have my greenhouse running, you know, and the optimum setup for me would be that you walk in and you have a little tiny locker room, you know, take a shower and you put on, you know, like coveralls that you work in the greenhouse. And then when you leave.
Did you cut off or?
Roger, you muted.
Oh, interesting. Okay. We can't hear you, or are you done, or?
I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got muted somehow. I thought I was on. All right. So what did you last hear? I'm sorry. I got muted. What I was getting at is the fact that, like, an operating procedure we've done in our greenhouses for produce for a long time. You know, you don't allow any and everybody to walk through your greenhouse and bring in, you know, insects or, you know, mildew or whatever. And a good way to do that for people that are out there wanting to get into the hemp industry or anything else is to make sure you have a room where people – you could even go this far, and I wouldn't have a problem doing this. You go to
you want to have double doors, and you want to have positive air pressure, and make sure that you have all that set up, you know, as part of your biosecurity for any facility. But we'll move on. So what are some of the other big issues you're seeing? You talked about rice root aphids. How would you go about getting rid of those?
One of the things that a lot of people overlook because they're not familiar with the root aphid physiology or how its life cycle operates is that it goes on the cannabis, sure, but it also feeds on many other plants, particularly Prunus, but also, and in my video that I mentioned a bunch of different species. One of the big ones is like wheat. It's a big pest also, like if you're in places where they grow a lot of wheat, where they grow a lot of rye, you know, rye is one of them. Now oats, yeah, barley, yeah. But like where they grow a lot of these grain plants, rice root aphid was a problem for them way before they were a problem for cannabis, at least documented, especially like recently. And so if you're able to cull or recognize some of those host plants, then get rid of them. Unless they're doing something for you that's like worth the liable risk, which is fine. Like I know people who are very attached to their ornamentals or they're very attached to certain plants because they provide food for the people like living on the farm or because any number of reasons. I'm not going to, you know, it's not my job necessarily to tell people like what they need to do, just that what they could do. And like, if that's, you know, if that's worth their cost benefit analysis, like no problem, then that's part of the plan. But like, you know, ideally you wouldn't keep the non-necessary host plants in the area unless there was some reason you couldn't. Of course, outside of your own property, there's not a whole lot you can do except for collaborate, hopefully, with neighbors. Sometimes you can build a good rapport with them. And, you know, just having that teamwork, if you're able to foster that connectedness with, like, agriculturalists to your left and your right, then that can be really useful. And I've seen that in places where that's been really great. And I've seen places where they really don't talk with each other and they'll always be like, oh, man, that guy, you know, constantly gets whatever and, you know, or powdery mildew or botrytis or something. And, like, they can't really affect that, you know, giant mass of powdery mildew or inoculum that's right across their fence line. That was a bit of a tangent, I suppose.
No, it's fine. They've been one of the harder things. I've had luck with Bassana or Bavaria Bassania, and then nematodes, and then H. miles combo seems to work relatively well, but.
What was that first part?
Oh, that Bavaria Bassania.
Oh, and yeah, the Bavaria Bassania.
Stradia laelaps, or what is it? Stradia laelaps schematis, or most people know it as H. miles. And then nematodes. But what are you know, that's what I've had really good luck with.
Yeah, I definitely have had the best luck with the Bavaria Bassiana, doing like a soil drench and just really making sure. And you can, I mean, like you can get really creative too. If you're an indoor facility, you can, you can exploit another aspect of their physiology, which is their heat intolerance. Most insects are exotherms. Exotherms are unable to, generally speaking, regulate their internal body temperature like we can through like sweating and things like that. And so aphids, like rice root aphids, there are research reports, and in my video I go over these life table aspects that like basically after like 30 degrees Celsius, like they start to have molting problems. Like, it just gets too hot for them. Like, when they're exposed to heat that's really that bad, they're going to try to find a place to cool off. And maybe they're able to find a microclimate where they're able to subsist. But if you're trying to, like, clear out a room and there's no plants or food there, you can use this as a strategy to make it worse for them. Ultraviolet radiation is also not great for them, although some aphids are more susceptible than others. But I guess my point is that, like, you can use combinations of, like, high temperature and, like, a biocontrol agent like Buveri Bassiana. And maybe even if you turn up the humidity and the heat, then you can really make things great for Buveria because as an ascomycete fungus, if I remember correctly, Buveria Bassiana does a lot better over a certain humidity threshold, like a lot of fungi do, and the increased heat might also help with colonization. Buveria Bassiana also exists as an endophyte, too, in many plants. So that's another really cool aspect of its use.
Yeah, I didn't know that was an endophyte as well. That's really cool. Is that how it was isolated to begin with? Or?
I don't believe so. I think it was first isolated as the causal agent of white muscardine disease. And I think that it was on, if I remember my bug lore, I think that it was on silkworms, or that might have been a different pathogen. But the one that's in products where the isolate is GHA, that stands for grasshopper active, and it was first isolated from a culture that was on Diabrotica spotted cucumber beetle. And then they reared it on grasshoppers a bunch of times in order to, like, adapt it to grasshoppers, because that was the original, the people who were making this particular isolate, that's what they wanted to utilize it for. But they ended up finding that it worked on a whole bunch of different insects.
That's really cool. I didn't know that. Well, is there any other ones you think that maybe keep you up at night or you're terrified of, or ones that you're kind of waiting to see really take off on the industry, or ones that people should be aware of?
I did already mention the spotted lanternfly, but I guess it bears repeating. And I do have a video coming out on it. I know of research reports that show Lycorma delicatula, the spotted lanternfly, feeding on hemp in China in the 80s and in the 40s. And there's no reason why that would necessarily be true now. And as it becomes an invasive in the United States of America, it's already cost like double-digit millions of dollars of damage and is expected to do a lot more, and especially more in places where viticulture, so growing grapes, and I think avocados are another problem. But cannabis is a big problem, too. And in these hemp fields, like, it's just, I think it's going to be a big problem for a lot of people. And we haven't seen it yet, so I think the responsible thing to say is that it's still speculation. But I think it's reasonable speculation based on research, if that makes sense.
Absolutely, absolutely.
There's also not a whole lot of biocontrol agents. So, like, there's definitely, like, chemicals that you could use, but nothing you'd want to use on cannabis. But we do use it in other crops. So that's kind of the other thing, is that specifically for cannabis, you know, some of those compounds are just not going to be, like, you just cannot use them. And so we will have that problem for people trying to grow, you know, organically, as they should.
That's really, really, really crazy. So, what are some of the upcoming videos and content you got coming up? You talked about a couple of the topics, but what are some of the other stuff you're working on?
I have I recently finished a manuscript for a journal that's coming out in a plant science journal, a phytopathology journal. That's on the cannabis pests of the United States of America. Microbial and arthropodal pests was in the title. That's what it was. And in it, I talk about some incidental pests, or at least I did in my first couple of drafts. I think that I took some of them out now that I think about it. But there are some pests that are like kind of regional to the United States, and like different parts of the United States that I've seen. Like, one of them is the buffalo treehopper, and there's two Stictocephalus species. One of them is Stictocephala bisonia, which is the bison, the buffalo treehopper. And then the other one is Stictocephala finahi, was it? Or no, that's a sharpshooter. But anyways, the point is that one of them has like a point, or one of them has like two points that look like horns, and the other one's got like a smooth head. And in the videos you can see, and I've been seeing them a lot in the West Coast, in California. I also saw like a similar kind of species that was like brown a lot, but, and there's no color morph that I know of for the two species. So that's probably a different species. It's either unrecorded or it's part of some journal that I've never seen before. And, the big problem with it is that it's a lot smaller than the spotted lanternfly. It's like 2 centimeters long or something as an adult. And they feed on the plant, but they don't cause a whole lot of damage. They do when they go to lay their eggs. So they have this egg-laying, like, organ, this ovipositor, and it's like a blade. It's actually, like, sharp enough that they can, like, cut into the plant tissue, and they can lay their eggs. And when they do that, they cause this like gnarly scar, and that can cause branches to break. And this usually happens in like the autumn and winter, or late summer even, which is now. And I know people who are currently suffering from these pests that are kind of like an incidental pest, not really a problem in other agricultural crops for the most part, but except for grapes maybe. But yeah, they're a problem here in cannabis cultivation. Yeah.
Awesome. How can people find more about your YouTube channel and more about some of the content? I know you also do talks as well. You have a talk on your YouTube channel, a whole length IPM talk.
Yeah, I haven't updated. I haven't done the like Zenthanol Live, which is usually just the video from my Instagram live, but I do have that. People who want to find my content, I have a Patreon for people who want to support some of my videos. I do it out of the kindness of my heart, and that's always going to happen. But if people want to help out with that, they can, and I'm willing to like help them out one-on-one with that sort of a thing, or like make special content for people who donate a lot more if they really want to like influence what kind of content comes out. They really want to see a particular thing addressed, and that's one way to do that. I have a treatise that I've written that's a living document that's constantly being updated on cannabis pests and pathogens that I've observed both in academic literature as well as my own observations, and I always make sure to get identification work and pictures and that sort of a thing to make sure it's accurate. That's also available on my Patreon, or you can buy it from me. I also have my science communication channel, Zenthanol, and my science communication Instagram account, Sync Angel, and I go over this sort of stuff. A lot of people I've seen in the chat, in the YouTube chat anyways, a lot of people were kind of aware of that already, it seemed. I definitely recognize some of the users, so it's kind of cool to see that interaction in the comments. And, yeah, I mean, like, I mostly put most of my content on those two social media accounts, YouTube and Instagram. And if you have any problems, I try to be available. It's hard to be everywhere at once, but I think it's really important to support people who are cultivating. So, yeah, if you have a small problem that I might be able to answer in a couple of words or something, then, you know, try your luck. If not, I'll let you know, and maybe we should talk more in a professional way. But
awesome. Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming on. We'd love to have you on again for another time. Maybe talk about fungal infections next time. I know I've seen a lot of septoria this year across the country. So
yeah, that would be awesome. I really enjoyed talking with you guys. I liked the breadth of questions. They were they really made you think.
Yeah, I know we got pretty deep and heady there for a minute.
I like the idea that you you brought up the fact that you'll help people out, but then you have a professional side, and that's where we're all going at this point. We've been helping out for a long time, and we got our crafts down, and now it's time to – we'll help you out with a few questions, but if it gets into something in-depth, you know, there's a professional side to it.
And, I appreciate that, too. I always like to say that if your business plan is not better than a Google search, you have a bad business plan.
That's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, it also kind of depends on what the intention is, you know. Like, there's, you know, plenty of, like, you know, people that just want to help, you know, like maybe growing their own first crop or something.
Exactly.
Like that. It's way different than somebody who's like, hey, you should, like, come write, you know, these SOPs, or can I just borrow your SOPs to start my, you know, tier two rent grow that I've never grown anything before, but I'd really just like to use all your stuff.
Well, you get these folks that have never grown anything, and they come in and they want to say, I'm going to start a grow with 10,000 plants. I'm getting in the industry. What do I do? What do I need? You know, that kind of thing.
I'm going to spend $2.5 million and not know I need to switch the plants to 12-12. Seen that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's it's just crazy. It's a, like, I love the best thing is, best thing I heard in the last few months, even though it's getting redundant now, but when they said Oklahoma's like the Wild West.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. And it is. I mean, you know, but they, yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
So, alrighty. Well, I don't want to tie up your whole evening. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you on again another time.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And, yeah, if anyone has any questions, just feel free to reach out. I appreciate that you guys are similar. That's really cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, feel free to hang out with you, man.
Yeah.
Hang out and shoot the shit. Yeah.
Pretty much every panelist besides me and Steve started out as guests, and that's how it went.
And they haven't been able to get rid of me, so here I am.
Keep trying. I'm just kidding. Marty, what's up with you and your grow? You been?
Marty, right on cue.
Hit, man.
Yeah, well.
So what's up with me? Let's see. Like, everything should be here. Tomorrow's Friday, right? Yeah, so everything will be here tomorrow when I get off work to start. Completely doing the exterior of the flower room in the garage. So that'll be 20 by 20, basically. So that'll be pretty cool. So I got everything from, like, well, we still have to cut holes in the wall for all the ventilation and stuff, but all the electrical's in, all the lights are in. So now we're just going to basically seal everything up. Put up all the fans, all the electricals put in for the fans and lights and everything. So that's all done. So once that goes in, then we can build the aquaponic system and start it cycling. I'm trying to get Caven to sell me some media. So hopefully he'll email me. I don't know if he's watching, but if you guys watched a few weeks ago, or was that last week? I don't know.
Last week.
We had Caven on from, what is it? Symbiotic?
Symbiotic aquaponics. Yeah.
So he was a cool guest, had a lot of fun on that show as well. If you want to check that out, he talked about some different media he had that he makes himself there in Oklahoma, right?
Yeah. Thanks again. I think Matt's got to run. Or at least in chat. Thanks again.
To be honest, I can keep going. I don't know what the standard operating procedure is. So.
You can hang out, and we're going to talk, and you can inject and ask questions of us. You know.
Yeah, for sure. So I just I just misinterpreted your chat. That's all.
So that'll come together. Then I can put together the aquaponics system like we talked about. There are some plants in it. That's going to be exciting. I'm trying to get some media from Caven. That's who I was just trying to poke at live. Hopefully, so he talked about this different media because obviously there's hydrogen, which is round and is expensive. And so he talked about how they set up this way to make their own, because they have tons of clay there locally, so they make it right in Oklahoma. And so I'm trying to ship him, or trying to get him to ship me a shit ton of this media. And so he's just working on getting the shipping for me. So he's probably working very hard, and I'm just poking him for no reason other than my own entertainment.
Well, it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool because, yeah, it's just about having red clay and putting it in the kiln. So.
Yeah, he says he doesn't normally, he only sells it with his system, so maybe we can leverage him into, you know, making it a available to sell. I think if it's that much better and it's sourced in the United States and, you know, can be even competitive in cost, then, you know, shit, why not?
I think one of the coolest things was he said that his, because it basically comes out to be an expanded clay again, but he made a claim that his contained minerals even after being fired and all, you know, which, you know, I don't know, because hydrogen, you know, is inert. Hydrogen's inert. So.
Right, but that could be a problem, though, because you don't have any control over leach rate. And
well, yes, yes.
I don't know. To me, that means I don't have control over nutrients.
I think you might want to just look at it and see, be like a thing to do a test thing. Like maybe Marty, for you to, you know, I love the idea with it because I've got a bunch of clay and you saw our interaction. I'm going, well, you know, I've been thinking about making bricks out of mine, but I would think if you fired it in a kiln, it would kill everything, but I don't know. I mean,
yeah, I mean,
he's claiming that he's getting minerals even out on the afterside. So
I understand what Steve's saying too, is that, you know, you don't control the leach rate, and I kind of know already what I'm going to get with hydrogen, but there was a time when I didn't know what I was going to get from hydrogen, you know, and it's not completely ideal, you know. So he talked about how, because his is elongated, it has more surface area, so it's more shaped like a bean instead of completely round. So I do think that there are just cool aspects of it. And like I said, there was a time where I just, you know, said, fuck it, I'm going to buy a shitload of hydrogen and lava rock, and that's going to be my media. And I didn't know anything about any of that then, other than just shit that I'd read online. So, you know, for me, it's not, you know, it's a leap, but you know, it's a leap that I'm willing to take if it all works out. I mean, obviously, if it's a big pain in the butt for him to ship it here, it's going to be stupid expensive for whatever reason, then I'll probably just do lava rock and hydrogen. But so that's really the last thing that I have to purchase is media for the flower room, and then we'll have all that set up and online. So that's going to be awesome.
And we have a class coming up at your place, right?
Yeah, so I'm hoping to at least have some plants in for a few weeks by the time you guys get here. So if I can get it online this weekend or even the beginning of next week, then I'll have plants in it right away, because I've got some ready to go. And then I'm trying to decide on my layout for the bedroom, because I actually have just a shit ton of headspace. I have a fucking 20-foot ceiling on one side of my shop. So I'm in the second story of the shop right now in the office. And the second story of the shop is above the garage, or what would be the flower room. And then next to me, behind this wall, is the headspace of the high bay shop. So it, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. Normally, you know, you're fighting against head height, and now I need to find a way to utilize it. So, you know, trying to decide on, you know, if I want to do something vertical, or how exactly I want to tackle that. So that's been kind of interesting to get into, but it's the nursery is going to be, you know, going to be online by the time of the class too. That's going to be, you know, it's a smaller overall system. So, and I have a lot of like the tanks and stuff that I'll set up for some different, cloning apparatuses that I want to try out for cloning and aquaponics. So I'll have a few different types of media beds and, test runs at first, that I'll be using to decide what I will do long term, and then I'll build out the rest of the nursery with those. So it'll be a little bit of a process to get it completely online. But you know, like I talked about in observing your own garden being the most accurate form of data. You have to do it in different ways in order to observe differences. So if they all work about the same, then I can just pick my favorite and it'll be a good problem to have. But the way I look at it is if I do it four different ways in four different media beds and even one of them turns out to be any remarkable percentage higher, then I can build out the rest like that. So that's kind of the overall plan. So I want to get all those set up and online, and those won't be large systems. They'll be small independent systems. So they'll be easy to get set up now that we've gotten a lot of the other harder stuff done, like getting all the electrical switched over to 220 and stuff like that. So that's what I'm doing. Shit that's not growing plants, which is a little frustrating, but it's preparation for growing a shitload of plants, which makes it tolerable.
Sweet. What about you, Roger?
This isn't
funny. We're doing the same kind of.
Oh, sorry. I was just gonna say I do actually have somebody who wants to hang out. So I will dip out, but I really enjoyed, and I'm just gonna say, see you next time.
All right, cool, man.
It was great having you, Matthew. I can't wait to talk to you again.
Yeah, tell people how to find you one more time before you take off.
Sure. Yeah. So, like the picture hopefully says, and it's not reversed. You can find me on Instagram at SyncAngel and on YouTube on Zenthanol. It's the same channel account that I was using to interact in the live chat. And I will talk to you guys later.
Awesome. Thank you. All right. Go ahead, Roger.
Oh, well, I guess, it's kind of funny how Marty touched on that. We've talked a lot the last couple of days, and our indoor grow is going to be I just get dropped?
You're here.
Oh, I'm here? Okay. Wow, everything just dropped out. Okay. On my screen.
Go ahead.
That's weird. We've decided to have we're going to build a 10 foot dual root zone bed and have some and do some pots and natural farming type live soil grows beds on the sides so that we can do some comparisons. So not just to say that one way is better than the other right off the bat in our grow environment. And so we're real excited about that. And I got a whole thing. I've been working on a concept for building LED lights. And I've done a lot of research on it the past 2 or 3 months. And we're going to try some of that and compare it with some of the other big lighting companies. At possibly a very good, very much less money spent. So we're going to do that same thing. Marty says he's doing four different mediums, and that's a great thing. I have to comment on that. I think it's a great thing for experimentation. And if you want to, you pass along your knowledge and share it with other people that you actually use different ways of growing and methods and mediums at this point, where Marty's doing one method but with four different mediums. Okay, so we're going to do an indoor climate control grow room with much in the same kind of space that Marty's talking about, where, and that's a nice space, 20 by 20. That's cool. That you could really you could produce in that thing, but the same kind of space area and do different types of grows. And also we're going to be experimenting with different LED lamps. So that's something that's going to be coming up in the next, from now to the next 6 months or whatever, when we're actually deep into a grow. So I'm real happy to talk about that. And of course ours is going to be hemp, and other than that, we're just gearing up we just got our first cool day. It's really nice outside right now. It's probably in the 60s, probably 60 something degrees. And Tomorrow is supposed to be in the high 70s. Of course, next week we're going to get back up in the 90s for a week. So it's kind of kicking up and down. But it's really a nice time where I live because everything I'm growing really starts to kick ass right now. And actually, that goes a couple of three or four warm days again. Next week will probably cause my vegetables and all to bulk up even more and suck up more, liquid and feed and it'll be great. But then we're on the cooling down period. And I got to say we went from winter to summer and we just went through a hurricane and I am glad that I'm feeling cool air when I walk outside.
That's good. I've just been working on getting everything going. I'll be off to the Kentucky State University
Aquaponics Association
conference this weekend. I'll be speaking there on Sunday. So I'll be over there talking this weekend. That'll be a lot of fun. And then just working on some other stuff that we're not quite ready to share yet. And yeah. Staying very, very busy, doing lots of number crunching, filling out visas, all kinds of fun stuff. So we'll have some cool stuff to share before too long. Sooner than later, don't worry. But yeah, other than that, just trying to think if there's anything I'm working on that I can tell you guys about. Not really at the moment. But we'll have some cool stuff soon, like I said. All right, well, we'll wrap things up. Again, check out Zenthanol. His YouTube channel is super informative on insects, pests, and beneficials, both. And then check out Roger. I'll just tell him where your stuff is.
Yeah, I'm at ilovegrowingmarijuana.com. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Cannabuzz, although I haven't really worked a lot with Cannabuzz and a little bit on Instagram. Facebook's the best way to get a hold of me where I could, share with you. And I also want to shout out for Marty for AP Meds at, he's on YouTube, he's on Facebook, and he's also
Patreon.
Patreon.
Yep. Yeah. And then check out JR Token over at Cannabuzz if you're looking for an alternative for Instagram. It's definitely a great option. You don't get banned over there. They're super chill. And it's designed around that whole concept. So.
Yeah, and he's a pretty cool, down-to-earth kind of guy, too. So I like that.
Alrighty. And thanks a lot, Tara Lee Live, for dropping links and stuff in the chat, holding down the chat. Appreciate it. And we'll catch you guys again next week. Next week we have Easy Clone, and then we have a gentleman who's going to be talking to us about using thermal imaging combined with other advanced imaging software and imaging methods to tell deficiencies in plants before they ever show visually. It's going to be pretty cool. So we'll have some really cool content next week. We'll catch you guys again soon. Cheers.